friends, welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comic Extension. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Chris Casso.
Hi.
I tried.
Hey, Ben. It's me, Cole.
That dulcet tone you hear over there is Mr. Cole Hornaday. How's it going, everybody?
We're on track because we're punchy by the third episode.
It's
punchy hour.
Cole's doing some fancy moves, and I lose my cool.
I'm sorry. It was the day we regret we're not capturing it all in living color on film.
All right, so Cole, before we start today's show, we got a thing coming up,
don't we?
You want to talk about that thing?
I do. Let me get back to it. So our friends over at Central Cinema, if you've never been, it's a wonderful little movie theater in the Central District where you can eat and drink and watch movies. And they do special events like showing a film in Hecklevision.
Yes.
So they've invited on, July 27th, Wednesday at 7 p.m. They're going to be screening the original Howard the Duck film in not Hecklevision, but Quacklevision. You've been practicing that, haven't you?
Since I was a kid. That's all
so
I can
apparently
say.
For Heckle/Quacklevision, you can text your snarky comments and have them show up on the screen.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool. What they do is they give you a phone number. They may even have an app, but you text your joke or your slam or you throw shade at Howard the Duck and it will show up on screen in this little ticker.
So we can all be the grumpy Muppets, two old men
in
the balcony.
Exactly, but totally Statler and Waldorf it. It is moderated, so you can't be too terrible. The guy who owns the joint is up in the booth going through and approving these texts.
So before you must suffer through the cinematic crime against humanity that is Willard Hike and Gloria Katz's Howard the Duck, produced by George Lucas. We're going to have a little entre-act, and Ben and I are going to present the Panel Jumper episode 4, An Odd Duck.
Yes, indeed. We will be showing it before the show, and we will be sure to tell everybody that there is no quackling.
No quacklevision.
During our episode. You must sit quietly and watch it reverently.
Sitting on your hands, verily.
We will approve laughing.
Yes.
But
at the appropriate times.
Yes, exactly. That should be exciting, though. So that was the last official episode that we released, episode 4, An Odd Duck, that we filmed right here at the Comic Extension.
That's right.
All about Steve Gerber and creator rights. And that is at 7 p.m. July 27th at Seattle Central Cinema.
Cinema.
You can find everything at central-cinema.com. And if you've never been to this place, it is one of the treasures of Seattle. It's locally owned, and they cook all their food from locally sourced ingredients. They have a great rotating tap and so you can sit and eat and drink, and it is all very reasonably priced. So please visit that place. I have a soft spot in my heart for it.
Got a little link for the event on the Panel Jumper page. If you have not already liked the Panel Jumper page, you really should, because you can get immediate access to all this fun information.
I will also put a link to it in the show notes for today. And let's move on. And what I want to talk about today is a topic that I'm sort of piggybacking on to something that we brought up a couple of weeks ago. And I can't remember why I thought of it, but it's how to follow creators.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say if I find a comic and I'm like, I really like this guy, but I don't have access to Chris or Nicole here at the Comic Dungeon who can tell me what else this creator's done. How do I find more about that creator? Is there an internet movie database for comic books?
Yes, there is.
Awesome. Let's hear all about it.
Comic book database.
Yep, it's
Comic book DB.
Comicbookdb.com.
And what's cool about it is, let's say you put in Joe Kubert, and it'll give you a list of... first, it'll want to confirm, is this the Joe Kubert you're looking for? And it's just a yes, there's one. But then when you click on it, you can look at everything he's written or inked or drawn. And when you click into one of those items, you can see the issue, and it'll also have credits for other people that worked on it. So you can keep branching through and finding people that are all connected. It's fairly up to date. I don't know. I don't look at it that often.
I use it as a reference here. And they will even give you like biographies on some of the creators, awards they've received, and it does stay pretty up to date. Now, I have found that there are some things that aren't on here, so it may not be the absolute 100% most comprehensive, but it is a fantastic resource. I've found a lot of things that I didn't will never remember on here, and so it's been very useful.
comicbookdb.com
All right.
Because I was thinking about this today. I was actually reading an article on auteur filmmakers and cineasts and how we've, in comic book culture, we've never really had something equivalent to that. Like, you know, Francois Truffaut worshipped the work of Alfred Hitchcock and wrote books and produced and inspired documentaries. So they analyzed Hitchcock's style and it informed creators, the French New Wave, how films were made going forward, and they coined language that we now use, homage and auteur and things like that. And we haven't really established that kind of language yet in comic books. We haven't really, you know, we hardcore comic book fans get deep into the appreciation of an artist's work. But, you know, I'm throwing this out to you guys. I mean, do you see the possibility of studying a comic book artist, a creator, or a team as you would a maker of film?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I mean,
Mobius would be somebody that's worth getting into. His entire career's worth, because it's also branched into cinema.
Right.
Because there's so many interesting parts of that, such as, like, he worked on Alejandro Jodorowsky's Dune, which never saw the light of day, but the production of that, the failed production, created some of the most famous movies in sci-fi. Mm-hmm. And also, it influenced a lot of things, like the Incall that Mobius worked on with Jodorowsky influenced the creation of The Fifth Element. But at the same time, he worked on The Fifth Element, and there was a lawsuit, but the judge was just like, well, you did everything, so no lawsuit. But like, so there's so many people that branch out into so many different fields that I totally believe you could do that.
So it kind of comes down to the breadth of inspiration that creator generates. It's just something I want to, I'm curious to how that will evolve, how we start looking at that as comic books have come to encompass so much more of our popular consciousness than they did 20 years ago,
right,
when we had cool books like Modern Masters and stuff like that, or the solo book from DC, where, you know, we honor the work, but we don't really look at how, you know, beyond people like, say, Kirby and Steranko and Steve Ditko,
right,
how
we pretty much stick with like five big guys.
Yeah.
And we do thankfully have sources from IDW and Fantagraphics that put an endless amount of work into doing homages and tributes to those creators, and guys like Joe Kubert too. I am curious if like the Joe Kubert School of Art actually does courses where they split it up and teach you of different artists from different generations.
You know, decades ago I talked with someone who was studying there, and you know, that person is long off my grid, and I would like to talk to somebody who's studying there currently and find out what that's like.
Cool. All right. And in comicbookdb.com. Now, something you find in the IMDb is you can also follow a character. Can you do that in comicbookdb.com? Like, let's say I wanna know what every single book is that contains Spider-Man.
You know, I'm not sure. I haven't looked that deep into it.
The individual publishers have their own, like, you know, they have Marvel Wiki and DC Wiki, but I have found those to be infuriating for research.
And they tend to have pop-ups.
Yeah, they're incredibly biased. They don't, you know, well,
they're
case
not
in point,
thorough is the problem that I find. Like, I want to look at issue numbers.
And say you go
instead, that it's just like a whole list of, like,
it's a morass.
And this happened. I'm like, but where?
I was trying to do research on Jason Todd for the episode that Ben and I are working on right now. And, you know, they nothing in the DC Wiki recognizes time periods, issues, points of origin.
Exactly.
It's this morass, and when you're trying to get, you know, and according to whatever reboot that's currently you know, leading how we're supposed to be reading this material, that was super duper frustrating. Shame on you. Yeah.
I will say as a loophole resource for that, there's a number of services where you can track your own comic collection. Mm. And one of them is called like Comic Collectors, but it's ends with a Z instead of an S. And you can scan in your entire comic collection. But what has been shown to me that I do like is that you can look at details of each comic in your collection. And it does feature like the creators, the artists, and then I think you can click, you could push the little Spider-Man button and it'll show you everything else that Spider-Man and that's in their database. Mm-hmm. So that is a way for you to be able to like check and see what you've got. So it's not exactly the same resource. It's also like you have to pay an annual fee for it, but I don't think it's that bad of a fee.
Yeah.
And what's kind of cool is if you have the app for your phone, like you could even put a mark on what books you're missing so that you know what to hunt for. And also, have I read the book yet? You know, you can just hit the check mark. So that's a way you could do it.
Yeah. It looks like Comic Book DB does... it does have on the creator page website information. I mean, generally, I think if you wanted to follow somebody, you could probably punch their name into Twitter and find them because everybody seems to be on Twitter.
Right.
But as far as being able to track what they're doing, I mean, there's a lot of self-promotion on there, so you can find out new projects and things.
Yeah, and I mean, because I reference IMDb probably once a day, you know, and so it's just like to remember what's that guy's name. Right. So I'm sure that in the not too distant future, there will be hopefully a singular tool where all of this information is collected and collated. And it sounds like Comic Book DB is on its way there.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, guys. Moving on, let's talk about pacing. We've touched on this topic a couple weeks ago and even a couple weeks before that. Let's talk about it because it seems to be an issue these days with good old DC and how their issues have sort of been delayed because I think they're overtaxing it themselves. So how is pacing important?
Didn't you?
No, well, I just want to clarify about, like, the question.
What is pacing?
Yeah. Well, between issues, internal pacing and storytelling?
I'm going to open it up because I don't know.
Okay.
First off, because we're
talking
about...
Are you basing this on how film is paced and how the rhythm of a film feels?
Let's split it up.
Okay.
Let's talk about, first off, distribution.
Okay.
All right.
Right? Yeah. Because that seems to be
accessibility.
The biggest thing. Right. And, like, how important is it to keep that consistent product out there for readership?
And we should probably clarify that the usual norm is once a month so that people kind of get their one shot of their favorite character on a monthly basis, usually around the same time of the month.
And that's been a standard across the industry for a while, and that the creators involved in that have a month to make an entire new issue, and that seems reasonable.
I like to think that they do them ahead of time a bit more, but that's not always the case.
Right. I think it's...
Yeah, they're not doing it that month, but, you know...
No, as a rule, they get started on a book about 4 months before it first hits the stands, if they're lucky.
I think it's changing a lot.
I was thinking about when, like, with the... they announced that Ta-Nehisi Coates was writing Black Panther and Brian Stelfreeze was going to be drawing it, but we didn't see that comic for 5 months.
At least. I think it was a while.
And it doesn't, I mean, that was, I think in the industry standards, that was a luxurious lead time.
Right.
Well, and like Image Expo from a couple years ago, they announced things and some of that stuff didn't come out for a year.
But for the best laid plans, if they're laid well, the idea is that there's a through line of continuity, a regularity that book is going to be hitting the newsstand so you can read it. So that was my whole point.
And like we've mentioned a lot that there's bi-weekly, there's weekly, and that's where a lot of our consternation is. It's worth mentioning things on the opposite side of that, which is like Love and Rockets was quarterly for a while, but they just announced that it's going to be monthly. But Saga has one of the most interesting schedules because it's so insidiously well-planned. Mm. So they're bi-monthly. And I don't believe they've missed a single date yet. I could be wrong about that, but it doesn't feel like they ever have. But what happens in the schedule is that when a story arc finishes, instead of the next issue coming out in that 2-month schedule, the trade paperback is released. And that gives them an extra bit of time to catch up. But it also means that people who do the I'm going to wait for the trade thing, it's like, well, one trade comes out a year because of the schedule. So you now either have to wait a year or you can jump in 2 months' time to the first issue of the next story arc of the trade you just read. Mm-hmm. And so it's basically plotting against people's their inability to be patient.
Patience, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's fantastic. It usually does bring in new readers of the bi-monthly title. And then some people stick to the once-a-year thing, and they'll find other books to fill the sad hole in their heart.
That is a true statement, because yeah. people get really bummed out when there's not a new saga.
Yep.
And they yeah. think there's a new saga.
And that allows retailers to have pre-planned sales pitches, because mine is always like, well, you should read Shudder. It's the right. next thing. You know, it's another sci-fi fantasy mashup.
We have an entire story here for you to explore yeah. while
exactly.
you're waiting for Saga.
So yeah. there's cases where, you know, those longer schedules really do work. And if I just like, I'm okay if somebody's like, I could only produce once every 4 months. It's just like, as long as you hit that 4-month mark and you yeah. said you would, we're golden.
Yeah, it comes down to consistency and communication.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people will, at Image, will take breaks. So they'll do a story arc, and then they'll take a few months off. And in the letters pages of those, which is the notes that the creators will put at the end of an issue, they'll say, okay, see you in 4 months or whatever, or like, we'll be back someday, if they don't know.
And we also have the season format that they're
yes.
learning from Netflix. Kaiju Max
yeah.
does that, where they will do a season, and then they won't launch the first issue of season 2 until the trade has come out. So it's just like Orange is the New Black and Game of Thrones. Like, you buy the season and you have to wait the next year to buy it again, or you can go and watch it and get the single issues, you yeah. know? So it's interesting that we're seeing those the translation
yeah.
of scheduling.
I would like to bring up that pacing as far as announcements versus actual release does make a difference,
mm-hmm.
because you want to say, hey, we've got a thing coming out. People get excited about it, but keep the interest going to the point where you'll actually get the orders. People will come in and know how to do it. Because the thing that with the Image Expo is people were like, I want that. And we were like, we can't do that yet. And then it's like, oh, yeah, I still want that thing. And it's like, we still can't do it. And then by the time it finally comes out, everyone's forgotten that it existed.
Right.
So it's like, until it comes out already, and then we'll sell out, and then we'll have to reorder. You know, so it's just this kind of chain of events that doesn't really fulfill for either the retailer or the consumer, you know, the reader.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what is an ideal scenario for that then? Like, if between announcement and product... on the
I
shelf.
Would love it if the product wasn't announced until it's solicited.
Yeah, and that would be about a 2-month cycle.
A 2-month cycle.
What does that mean to be solicited?
It's in my order form at
okay.
that point, and it has a code that's in our software that I can put someone onto. So the moment that they're like, I want this, can you remember? I'm like, I don't have to remember. I hit a button, you're getting it.
Right,
yeah.
So somebody sees that something's been announced online, they come
yep.
to you, and you have
yeah.
all, you have access to just electronic to yeah. electronically... punch a button.
Yep, because as yeah. it is right now, if somebody said, I want to, oh, when Black Panther was first announced,
yeah.
and they're like, oh, make sure to give that to me. I'm like, I can't make a note. And they're like, well, why can't you just remember it? I'm like, you're box 900.
yeah.
And I mean, I could make a sticky note. I'm going to lose it. You know,
yeah.
I have a billion, I get a bare minimum of 25 new emails a day. It's more like 50. And it's just one of those things of like, I can try and keep notes, but I need to be able to just like, you want thing, I push button, you get thing.
Yeah.
And so when that news makes it out so far in advance, it's terrible. I just would like people to hear about thing and be able to tell me they want thing, and I could take care of thing in the same breath.
And like back to the previews catalog,
yeah.
it'll be like, so right now we're looking at July previews, and they always say July for September.
Right.
Is that right? Is that 2 months out? July, August, September.
Yeah, yeah, that'd be about right.
So
yeah.
they say July for September. So there's solicitations that are usually around September. So like DC will do that kind of 2-month cycle. Not everybody does. It could be like July for December, because we don't really know. You know, it could be way further out, but it's at least 2 months out. So you're ordering for 2 months from now.
Cool. All right. Do any have any titles in your recollection, have they just, has the readership just fallen off completely because they've missed so many deadlines? And
well, every superhero book from Image, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't that?
Well, here's an example. Remember when everybody cared about Mark Waid's Strange Fruit?
Yeah,
remember that was a thing?
We all talked about it.
It still hasn't finished.
No one cares. You took too long. Now your candy's gone.
And didn't,
That's what happened. And didn't we talk about that?
Because I had suggested that we as a group discuss it. And
nothing
I think that
to
was.
Return.
And I think that was Chris's comment was like, why bother? It's going to. What's the matter?
But when it gets collected, and we still haven't had that discussion yet. Yeah.
And since it's from Boom, even when it finishes, the collection will take a year and a half to come out because Boom doesn't understand how the market works. Yeah. I just hit a. I think I just basically caused an aneurysm.
Nicole is holding her forehead like
it's like a brain freeze.
You have an ice cream headache, but it's
it is
like
exactly
the
an
spiritual
ice cream
kind.
It is.
But as an example, for Image, they have Rat Queens, and Rat Queens has been plagued by problems, and it's just late. So the thing is, my sales are inconsistent, and my trends are inconsistent, and that causes a retailer to want to retreat in their commitment of shelf copies.
Right.
As long as people don't commit to a subscription, I'm just like, well, my sales show that I sold 25 shelf copies, but it was 5 months between that issue and the next, and it looks like I only sold 10 the next time around. So why should I order anything more than 10 if I only sold 10? And it's just because a lot of people who are getting into comics now, they don't really want to commit to a subscription. And
or maybe they don't know about subscriptions, because I didn't know about that when I first started.
So they just kind of pop up. And if the thing you want is never there every time you pop up, you're going to forget about it. You're not going to care about it. Or you're going to say, I guess I'll get it when it's collected. You know, so lost opportunities due to late schedules.
Yeah. So that, that's a little bit of pacing.
Sorry. That's good illustration. Thanks, guys. Let's talk about internal pacing. Cole, do you have something to say about the story pacing and how maybe if it's terrible, it totally throws you off of the book?
Not really. I was trying to think of examples of artists who and writers who successfully dictate the tempo within the story through imagery. I'm sorry, I'm going to go back to Frank Miller, Keith Giffen used to talk about, I think you've talked about too the appropriate size for
the nine
Scott
panel
McCloud
grids.
Talked about it. Oh, yeah, say that again.
Nine panel grids.
Right. Yeah. Right. And how that can dictate the rhythm of how the story is told, and going from a nine panel grid to a splash page, and then what that does to the visual rhythm.
And it also dictates the tone and atmosphere in so many ways, because as an example, there was that beautiful but never completed series by Warren Ellis and Ben Templesmith called Fell. They were committed to doing nothing but nine panel grids. Mm-hmm. And it was a $2 comic, and they're like, we're giving you the most bang for your buck.
Right.
Well, the problem with that is A, you have to put more work into it, and everything's shrunk down. So Ben Templesmith, even if he wanted to draw like a long scene of a dark hallway, he had to miniaturize it because of a nine-panel grid system. Mm-hmm. So it was overworking the poor man.
Yeah.
And some people can draw tiny, tiny things, and others can't. So that's where it can work sometimes. Alan Moore is a huge fan of nine-panel grid layouts, and a lot of cinematic zooms in and out. Like he does it from that thing. So there's a lot of people who are very committed to that, but there's a lot of people who just can't do that anymore. There's a lot of people who've given up, and I love Mike Mignola, but he loves his splash pages.
Yeah, I'm just pulling open the latest issue of Hellboy and Hell and looking at how very cinematic and these epic scales of images, and they're languid. They are rich images, but they're not busy.
Right.
So it's kind of equivalent to how, it is equivalent to how the cinematographer's guiding your eye over something and dictating the rhythm there. Mm-hmm. And that can also be done with dialogue. And I, one of the things I always go back to is Howard Chaykin's use of font styles and repetition of font as imagery, you know, and he, you know, he would have someone would have an automatic rifle, and it would just be these series of words saying mau 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 mau, you know, and that I always thought that was so really innovative and exciting. You don't see people doing that a lot, but that was like part of his storytelling style in American Flag back in the day. But you don't see, and I'm sorry about that. I miss that. I think that's a lot of fun. Because it plays with the medium and it plays with the storytelling, the rules of storytelling.
Well, if I may, going back to the way that you do paneling and how to tell the story and how to do pacing, there's a couple titles, like, I always go back to Batwoman Elegy because J.H. Williams has a very interesting style. He'll do a very clean, very, I don't know if it's nine panels per page, but he does something similar to that where they are very similar sized panels of just like having conversation or something, and then something will sweep through the panel, or then it's Batwoman and her cape is flowing and it just becomes this whole other thing. It just becomes this,
because
big,
it's very painterly
page. Very painterly. But even something like Gem and the Holograms, where it's very simple paneling, but then all of a sudden they're having they're having a show and it's a music thing, and then it looks kind of J.H. Williams style where the music is all over the page and, and flowing, and
it
leads the eye, and you get something visual that you're supposed to get auditorially, but because it's a comic you don't. You know, so I feel like that's a really great way to show your pacing, but that's also a very successful way.
One of the things we don't talk a lot about are foreign comics. We don't talk a lot about manga, and I was thinking about how that format, particularly Samurai Executioner and Lone Wolf and Cub, you know, that the manga digest size, and how that dictates how you read a book. And those books were, if you've ever read Lone Wolf and Cub, it's fascinating because they're these little digest books, and they were meant to be read by a Japanese salaryman on the trains and students. But, you know, you've got a 20-minute ride, and that book is going to entertain you for that 20 to 30-minute ride on the train, and it's timed that way.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. There's a book that I've been reading that is very anecdotal, and it seems to jump all over the place. That like at one moment, like these two girls who have crushes on each other are like having a cooking thing at their house, and then the next thing they're like at school talking about an orange or something, and you're like, what? I don't know. Like, it just goes kind of all over the place, and I feel like I've missed something, but I feel like it's because it was probably produced in a different way originally, and then it got collected all together and smushed together, and now you're just sort of reading these little snippet, like vignette type things. But I'm expecting this continuity of being like, well, you had a conversation on Monday, but now all of a sudden it's Friday, but now it's like last Tuesday. You know, it just jumps all over the place. So that's what's confusing about pacing, and especially like bringing manga over and how they collect it, I think makes a big difference.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It can be frustrating if a story like that just jumps all over the place. Yeah. You as a reader don't really know where you are at any given time or what's going on.
It's confusing.
So, any final thoughts on pacing in terms of story?
I was just going to basically say that the best creators can show you a story and not tell you a story.
Yeah.
I was just reading the first issue of Civil War, and they failed in that regard. Civil War II,
right.
Electric Boogaloo. And and basically Bendis, because of the way he writes, tells you something's important. He doesn't show you something is important. He didn't pace it out to the point where the villain had a chance to actually prove why he's a threat. Bendis just told you he's a threat and why you should be scared.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that's not great storytelling.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's a difference between just having the same person in like a superhero thing that you need to see some sort of action versus something like Alison Bechdel, Are You My Mother, where she's having a conversation. The paneling might be similar, but you get a lot of word bubbles, but it makes sense in the context. Well, in this context, it's like falls flat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So there's a time and a place for each style. You know, the 9-panel grid allows for great exposition. It's lousy for action. You know, yeah. That's where like a Jack Kirby comic will show you the how much of a master he was, where, you know, if he had to tell you the background to a sci-fi story, panels start to shrink down. But by the time the big monster shows up, it's big splash pages and action, and it's just amazing. So it's about being appropriate at the right time for how you want to tell your story.
Definitely.
Yeah. Rock and roll. All right. Thanks, y'all. Let's move on to Book Report. And Chris, let's start with you. What do you want to talk about this week?
So I'll talk about the new Tales from the Dark Side from IDW. It's by... Well, so this is interesting. They do basically sell it as the team of Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez, which is the team from Lock and Key.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I read the solicitation. So I'm like, yeah, he's actually writing it. It's not just adapted from him. But then I open it and it says, script is by Joe Hill, adaptation is by Michael Bendetto. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? And it turns out that I don't know if this is like four issues long or whatever, but these are based off of the scripts that Joe Hill wrote for the actual TV series that this was going to produce. Mm. And they actually are making a hardcover that's the script book. So it is written by Joe Hill, but this comic book adaptation script, I don't think it is, but they're being tricksy. It does look like Lock and Key because it's Gabriel Rodriguez. So it is and it isn't by Joe Hill.
I remember when this book was announced and I thought they were actually adapting Tales from the Crypt.
So the format is that each issue is going to be like a different story, kind of like a Tales from the Crypt kind of thing, or Tales from the Dark Side. And there will be a unifying factor. There's a character that shows up. They're like, oh, he's going to probably show up in the next one. And Joe Hill in the back says like, yeah, you know, I had this broad picture for like a 2-season show where each episode was standalone, but it would knit together a tighter universe. I'm really sad that that's not what we're going to get. And we're going to get this miniseries that is and is not written by him. It's kind of like Schrodinger's comic writer.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah. And it's just kind of like, I wish they would be honest about that. Because there's been 3 or 4 things from IDW where I'm just like, it's Joe Hill. Oh, it is, but it's not. It does read like him, but there's a subtle difference in tone that it doesn't hook me as fast as Lock and Key does, but that's mitigated by Rodriguez's art style. I just really like his style. This specific story is about a lifeguard who fell asleep on duty and somebody died because of it, and he's racked with guilt because of that, and dark side events happen where basically something supernatural suddenly takes place and changes the character's life. And in this case, anybody that sees him falls asleep. So he's kind of dealing with those shenanigans. It's an interesting story. It's a very depressing story. I think it's true the tone for what they're going for. I liked it, but I'm still in a place of not sure what I read because who wrote it, because
right,
I just don't get that. So I will say yay. I'll give the next one a shot too.
I like Joe Hill. I read the first Lock and Key and really enjoyed him. Every time I learn something new about this guy, I'm really impressed. The last thing I heard was that his own publisher didn't know he was Stephen King's son until after Joe Hill had already,
because if you look at
published
the guy,
his first thing,
he looks like mini Stephen King.
Like, kudos to Joe Hill for keeping that a secret, because he could have gotten so far in life just writing his father's coattails. But no, he decided to do it on his own. And
well,
like,
it hasn't been an easy road for him. He's suffered a lot of. He's got some mental challenges. He's got some. I think he's bipolar. I know he's got some mental illnesses. So, I mean, this has not been an easy creative path for this guy. There was a
creative paths never are.
Yeah, no. So so what I'm saying is I admire him on several levels.
Yeah.
I'll say my understanding of Lock and Key is that it is the first comic series that he's ever scripted, and it reads better than a lot of people who've been in the industry much longer than him.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm always disappointed when I find out a project's not entirely his doing.
You feel cheated.
I'm trying to figure out like how much of it is and what am I getting, and I don't want to downplay the other creator, but at the same time it's like I wanted my Joe Hill.
All right. Well, anyway, Tales from the Dark Side, number one. Thank you, Chris. Cole Hornaday, what do you got for us?
Well, I have an end of an era. Hellboy in Hell number 10. It was announced shortly before this one hit the stands that this was going to be the last Hellboy story that Mike Mignola was going to write and illustrate. He claims that he intended to spin the story out longer. It's kind of a mystery to me why he decided to wrap it up. It's by no means abrupt, but I am sad and I'm disappointed that he's either burnt out or lost his passion for telling these stories. I mean, it's not the end of the character. There's still plenty of other, you know, Mignola-verse things happening at you know, Dark Horse, like the BPRD and the Abe Sapien book, and there's the flashback stories with Hellboy. So there's plenty of opportunity to enjoy those stories. But to me, this was always Mignola's character. It was his creative property, and all other representations of the character paled in comparison to Mignola's work. So this is, Hellboy's been dead for a while, but, you know, when you're a supernatural being and the son of Satan, what does that really mean? And we know from the movie and from the comic book that at some point Hellboy becomes, and I always have to write this name down, he will become, you know, the Prince of Hell, Anung On Rama. I think I got that out of my mouth right. And my theory that I've voiced on the show before has been that all of the Mignolaverse books, the BPRD, and, you know, the apocalyptic stories are happening in that, and Abe Sapien, we're all going to fulminate in Hellboy, you know, becoming Anung On Rama, and that was going to be the climax of everything. It was all going to come together, and it was going to be really exciting and really cool. And I had this really great way of, like, making up stuff that's just never going to happen.
Sorry, every time you say his name, I get hungry.
Anung
Top Rama.
Rama. Yeah. So
Top Rama.
So to the book itself, this book is gorgeous. It's really interesting because it starts with the quote from John Donne, you know, ask not for whom that bell tolls, it tolls for thee. And there's very little dialogue. Hellboy says nary a word, and you see him in the guise of Anung Rama with his giant horns, you know, meandering through hell and destroying all the other lords of hell. So he basically demolishes hell and brings it down around his cloven feet. He goes back to the little cabin. I'm going to spoil the crap out of this for everybody. He goes back to not his little cabin, but his little house that he was living in, and the lights go quietly out, and that's it.
It's already been posted online.
Yeah.
I even read that.
Right. And I'm kind of puzzled by what this all means because, you know, if you read any books by Neil Gaiman and any of the Vertigo stories, it's been, or any stories, it's like you can't just shut down hell. It's a constant. It's a cosmic constant in any mythological structure. So that was what's kind of puzzled me in the story. It's like, well, you know, good night, sweet prince, but, you know, what are we doing now?
So when you started to get to the end of this issue, did this song start playing? Closing time.
No.
Time for you.
No, actually, it did not. No.
Let you out into the
world. Because I feel like that would have been appropriate.
You know what happens when you shut down hell? You just start another franchise, which is the Dawn of the Dead. You know?
Sure. When the gates of hell fly open, the dead shall walk the earth.
Yeah. Don't actually, dead open inside.
No, actually, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I heard They Might Be Giants. Blue Canary in the Oven by the Light Switch. Who watches over you? Make a little birdhouse in your soul. No, I didn't hear any of that stuff. I actually was really sad because Hellboy has always been one of my favorite characters. I have three favorite characters, and they're all kind of Frankenstein-esque. It's Hellboy, Paul Chadwick's Concrete, and Swamp Thing. I don't know. I'm sure he'll come back to the character, but no one will ever render the character the way Mignola does. And it's a beautiful book, and it's puzzling, and it's mysterious, and I'm not sure. And maybe down the road we'll learn more about why he made this choice. Don't stay away too long, Michael. We'll miss you.
All right. Well, thanks for that lovely obituary there, Cole Hornaday. Nicole, what do you got for us this week?
I got a preview of the new Scholastic title by Raina Telgemeier called Ghosts. And it's a story that she's been working on and shaping for maybe around 14 years. But finally, around, I think, 2012, she decided to really take it on. And it's these two sisters, Katrina and Maya, and her and their family. And they're moving to this just small town in California. Her sister, Katerina, is the main character. And Maya is the younger sister, and she's got cystic fibrosis.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no cure for that. And so they're moving closer to a hospital that will be able to take care of her. And it's her sister dealing with the move and going to this new place. Like, oh, we're right by the water. Look how beautiful it is. Yeah, but it's really cold here. Or like, you know, like, look at our cool new house. It's like, yeah, but it's really dark in here. So it's like the sister's trying to deal with stuff while Maya, who's got cystic fibrosis, is full of life and she's spunky. And then all of a sudden she'll get this terrible cough attack, which has happened because cystic fibrosis, you have fluid constantly building up inside of your lungs. And they even put her in this little vest that vibrates so that it mm-hmm. kind of vibrates the mucus around
mm-hmm.
and, it shuts the power off, you know, and then they're trying to navigate through there. It seems very, very interesting. I love Raina's stuff. This is something that is scheduled to come out September 13th or 14th, depending on what day that lands on. And you can pre-order it now. One of my favorite books by her is Drama. I feel like Ghosts might be a second to that, just based on this little snippet, which is kind of like an issue worth of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely pre-order that.
It's worth noting that this is one of the highest selling graphic novels across bookstores and Drama was, or maybe Smile was. Yeah,
Drama's one of those gems that they, like, they'll read Smile, they'll read Sisters, but they won't have read Drama.
Right, Smile.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the numbers. I want to say it's like over 250,000 copies sold for a graphic novel. That's like big numbers.
Yeah.
So I'm actually ordering like almost higher than Saga on this. In my
this
current
is gonna
order
be
forms.
Good. I'm really excited for it.
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
All right, Ghosts by Raina Telgemeier. Did mm-hmm. I get that name right?
I think so.
All right. Thank you, Nicole. So that's Book Report, and that's our show. But before we go, play quiz time. But before we do that, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound Podcast is brought to you by the Panel Jumpers, the everything Nicole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. Come
what?
To see
what.
Howard the Duck and our
Cracklevision.
In Cracklevision at the Comic Extension. We'll have one more week to remind you before that actually happens.
All right, cool.
And also by the Comic Extension here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicextension.com. You can also subscribe to us at on iTunes. Leave us a review if you'd like, or at perfectboundpodcast.com via any other method with which you receive your podcast. Or just listen to it there. I don't care. Just hit play, and it'll play for you. What else do I want to say? Email us. Did we get anything wrong? Do you have anything you want us to talk about? Talk about how
send quiz questions to us.
Send in quiz questions.
Yes.
Talk about how that side of the table has beards and this side of the table has none.
That's right.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
All right.
We are beard divided.
With that, it's get your quiz hats on, everybody. It's quiz time this week. The questions come to us from Mr. Chris Casso. Lay it on us, Chris.
Yikes. And now I wish I had a whole bunch of questions about beards in comics.
Oh. Okay, save that one for later.
Yes. So
John
I was
E, take
I was,
note.
I was trying to come up with something with based on what we had as themes for this episode that I gave up. And then this one's just called
Who's... Hey, man, I found one for Road Trip.
Yeah, good job.
I got lazy then. So this one's called Who's Your Super Baby Daddy Mommy?
So this
is about who the parent is.
Super
so
baby here's daddy the mommy.
Okay. Yeah, here's the easy first one. This grandson of the demon's head is also the child of a world-famous detective, as well as caregiver to a dog, a cat, and a cow. What is this child's name, and who is his father?
Damian Wayne, son of Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
The current Robin.
Yeah. Yeah.
First of his name, House Wayne.
The son of the demon.
Next one is, which hero was led to believe that his child died at childbirth when in fact she was kidnapped and taken to Europe?
Ooh.
She later became the star of her own title, where she donned the same costume as her father and crawled on walls. try not to make it too obvious.
Spider-Man
is the parent.
Yeah.
Spider-Girl.
Yeah.
It was the alternate continuity.
But they did establish that the baby did exist in continuity.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh, who was the mommy?
Mary Jane.
It was Mary Jane.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, basically, Norman Osborn kidnapped a baby and they replaced the baby.
But was the baby a clone?
No.
Was Norman a clone?
Probably. I don't know.
Next. Wait, next, please.
Tom Bronson never knew his father while growing up, but when he finally met him, they slowly formed a bond, and Tom was trained by his father, who also trained a number of other great heroes, such as Black Canary and even Batman. Tom would share his father's superhero name, which was...
Wildcat.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Next.
I'm glad you knew that.
Dinah Laurel Lance has been in the Justice Society and the Justice League as the heroine Black Canary, but she follows in the footsteps of her superhero mother. Who is her mother? You don't have to give me the real name. This is a superhero name.
I'm just trying to think of a random lady superhero.
Liberty Bell?
No, this is DC. It's stupid. Black Canary.
What?
Her mother's name is Dinah. Dinah's mother is Dinah, and her name was Black Canary.
Lazy authors.
Okay,
Hal Jordan's cousin is
Liberty
Hal
Bell
Jordan.
Was whose mom, though, from Marvel?
No, from DC. Oh. Liberty Bell's mom, Liberty Bell was the mother of Jesse Quick.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Anyway.
Yes. Thank you.
Here's the last
Good
one.
Grief.
Now, bear with me on this one.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
There's a lot of words there.
Yes. Because this
no
is...
No cheating.
This is
I'm
so
not,
terrible.
The words.
This is so terrible. Just listen to it. Shatterstar is the only Mojo World rebel who was not created by Ares the Creator, as he is in fact mysteriously appeared from the sky one day, as he did. Ares then used Shatterstar's genetic material to create Longshot of the X-Men, making Shatterstar the father of Longshot genetically. Mojo later attacks Ares' sanctuary, so Shatterstar time teleports himself to a time in Mojo World's history when Dazzler and Longshot are married and fighting a war against Mojo. Dazzler, pregnant with Longshot's child, goes into labor and gives birth to a young Shatterstar, who Shatterstar explains he's going to be delivered to the future of Mojo World to be raised by other people. But, yeah. Who is responsible for the stupidity? Who is the father of the story?
Paradox, you're soaking in it.
Was it Peter David?
Yep.
Wow. The man who hates time travel continuity stuff because it gives him intestinal cramps.
Yeah, it's like Shatterstar is his own grandpa.
Yeah, he's my own grandpa.
Fifth level.
Yeah,
that is
Peter David's humor in a nutshell.
Yeah.
It's still
shame
horrible.
On you. Shame on you.
All right, well, that's quiz time. Thank you, Chris, and thank you all for a lovely evening, and thank you.
Well, thank you for a lovely evening, Ben Lawrence.
I enjoy our time together here, and thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.